A couple is going through a nasty custody battle, and then they go viral for the worst reason imaginable. Their 9-year-old daughter, Sophie, alleges that she is being sexually abused while at her mother's house. The case is investigated, but 1 year later, in July of 2021, Sophie's dad, Michael, abducts her. He claims that he's trying to save her, but Sophie's mother claims that he's the dangerous one. Now, in September of 2021, Michael is still on the run with Sophie, and people are left wondering who's telling the truth. When a person goes missing, there's a special kind of pain in the not knowing. I want to tell the stories of those who never came home. I want to tell you the story of Sophie Long. I'm Kona Gallagher.
And I'm Ethan Flick.
And this is And Then They Were Gone. Everyone.
Hello, welcome.
Thank you for joining us once again. We've actually picked up some new listeners lately, so I'd like to say hi and welcome to all of the newbies here. We've been also doing this for a little over a year, so maybe we should reintroduce ourselves.
Okay. Sure.
I'm Kona.
I'm Ethan.
Yeah. I'm a realtor, a mom, and a true crime addict.
I am 17 years in law enforcement, although I'm not going to tell any of you which agency I work for. And I happily go along with whatever my wife fancies at the moment. And right now, it's been podcasting for the past year and a half.
But that's a big deal that you said that because, you know, when we first started, you wouldn't even say that you were in law enforcement. You made me leave it off of the website.
Yeah, well, so
I think it was like episode like 25 or so where you finally let it slip.
Well, it's a tricky thing. You know, I'm commenting on things from a law enforcement perspective.
Right.
And while I want to have some validity behind what I'm saying, given that I have law enforcement experience, I can't give too much away because of my job.
Right. So, and the nature of your job is different.
It is. Yes. I'm not an investigator.
A lot of what we're talking about.
Right. I'm not an investigator.
Right.
I have never alleged to be an investigator.
Yes.
My work is completely different from that.
Right. So it is weird because you are in law enforcement, but you're not in the law enforcement sector that we typically talk about in the show.
Correct. However, I will say this, though. The one thing about law enforcement is that, generally speaking, training kind of across the board kind of overlaps with everything. So I have a little bit of a taste of what we're dealing with. Not specialized, of course. But that's where my background is, and that's why I can add some insight to things.
Yeah, and I think that's important because I think that is where we get, I think, the best of your knowledge and in terms of how it pertains to the cases we cover is through the training. Because you're right, like, no matter what your specialty ends up being, like, regardless of your department or your title, you go through a lot of the same training.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
And on top of that, previous to going into law enforcement, I was a social worker. I was an intake investigator.
Well, honey, you don't know anything about the episodes before we record them, but spoiler alert, that's going to come up in this one.
Oh, yeah. Your first, like, two lines, I had, like, all of the feels.
Yeah.
You know, like, I'm getting so many things that I immediately want to say away, but obviously I'm gonna hold off before we dive headfirst into it.
Yeah, this is going to be really rough. It's a two-part episode. I'll say that right off the bat.
I hate two-part episodes.
I know you do, but And I did intend it. I never intend to do a two-part episode. But, and you know, I didn't think this was going to be one because it's so recent. And typically with more recent cases, like there just isn't enough information to do a two-part episode. I mean, a lot of times there isn't information to do a regular one-part episode. But this has different phases to it. And so there are two main phases. There's the Stand with Sophie phase and the Bring Sophie Home phase. And so today we're going to be talking about the Stand with Sophie phase. Next week, we'll be talking about the Bring Sophie Home phase. This story is rough. And in case you didn't get it from the intro, we do deal with child sexual abuse in this. I do not go into details about that.
Nor should you.
Yeah, but there's no way to tell this story without mentioning it because it's a central part of it.
Sure, yeah. I mean, obviously bring that up, but I don't think you need to get into the nitty-gritty of it.
No. So I do want to say that right up top because, you know, like there's a lot of stuff I choose not to listen to or watch or whatever. And I know that this might check that box for a lot of people. So I want you to know up front so that if you want to skip these next two episodes, like definitely do that. Just do whatever you need to do for yourself.
Can I skip these next two episodes?
Well,
and not just from the fact that I hate cliffhangers, but also I'll do my best to try and not to trigger my own emotional issues from my shitty childhood.
I know. It's
you know, I and maybe I can add some perspective on that too, depending on how this goes forward. Though I was never sexually abused, I definitely should have been in the system.
Yeah.
So I'll be interested to see where we go with this.
Yeah, honestly, one of the reasons why I limited the scope of this podcast to unsolved missing persons cases is because I didn't want to write about violence and murder, and especially violence against children. But this is a current and active case, and Sophie, one way or another, is in danger right now. So it's important to talk about it, I think. And I think it's important to, you know, get her story out there more and make sure that the proper authorities are doing what they need to be doing. All right, so let's get into it. Sophie Elise Long was born on September 16th, 2010, to Michael and Kelly Long. There's not a lot of biographical data available about Sophie or her family, but I do know that she's the oldest of three kids, and she has two brothers. Michael and Kelly, her parents, split in 2015, so all three of the children were quite young at the time. So Sophie was the oldest, and she would have been about five. This is the type of divorce and custody situation that has kept both parties in court for years. Visitation agreements have changed. Supervision rules have changed. It's been an abject just disaster. In fact, they can't even agree on the reason they got divorced in the first place. Michael alleges that Kelly was unfaithful and emotionally abusive, while Kelly calls him an abusive husband. And we kind of alluded to this in the intro, but I do want to reiterate up front, like, how we're approaching this case. So we each have one child from previous relationships. They're just a little bit older than Sophie is now. Sophie is now 11. Our kids are 12. And our oldest is actually going to be 13 the day this is released. Uh-huh. This is actually his 13th birthday. So we've dealt with exes and custody agreements.
Yes, but it sounds like not nearly as heated as this.
Oh, no, not at all.
I think we, generally speaking, you know, we kind of made out as far as that goes. Like, we have very agreeable exes.
Yes.
And we're all kind of on the same page, and it's been relatively smooth.
Right. Like, we've had bumps in the road because, like, obviously
minor,
we're going to.
Minor,
but
though.
I mean, nothing approaching this level, but like, with that said, again, the whole concept of having like a custody agreement and trying to like work out these things is something that we both do have experience with.
Oh, for sure.
again, so this is the part that you alluded to before entering law enforcement. You also spend a year working for Child Protective Services.
Yes.
So, you know, we talk a lot about that in this case. So you have the experience of seeing these situations from that end, which is not something that I have ever done.
Yeah, well, it's not a pretty thing to be on that side.
No, absolutely not. When Michael and Kelly divorced in 2015, things seemed at least relatively amicable, and the couple was basically awarded 50-50 custody. So, you know, and I think typically that's how it goes, unless there's some issue that's identified during the divorce proceedings. I think the default at this point is, you know, 50-50, unless there's a reason not to do it that way.
Yeah, and the issue doesn't necessarily have to be adverse to one side or the other. You know, it could be something like...
Like one parent travels 80% of the time for work or
exactly,
something like
right.
that.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean they're a bad person. It just means that they
correct.
Can't have the kids 50% correct. Of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah. So this arrangement apparently went on for a while, and, you know, both of the parents eventually moved on. Kelly began a relationship with a man named Jake Billingham, and Michael married a woman named Courtney Chalmers. And while I'm sure everything was not perfect, like, nothing seemed to be too far out of the ordinary at first for a divorced couple trying to co-parent. They had their issues, according to Kelly, starting, you know, back in 2016, 2017, so not too long after they got divorced, but... Things didn't get truly bad until 2020, where things seemingly took a very dark turn. Michael Long says that during a FaceTime call with his oldest son, and all right, so I'm going to stop myself right here. Again, there are three children. Sophie's the oldest. There are two boys. I know the names of the boys, but I'm just going to kind of like leave their names out of this. Because Sophie, unfortunately, she already has an internet presence. She's officially a missing person right now. Her name is out there. Her photos are out there. Like, she's there, but I don't think the younger boys need to be brought into it in that way. So we're just going to be referring to them as, you know, the child or things like that. We won't be referring to them by name. So anyway, back to this FaceTime call. Michael was having a FaceTime call with his oldest son, who was 7 at the time, and he thought that the boy was acting kind of strangely. When it was his turn to have visitation, Michael told Nancy Grace in an interview that his mother, Michael's mother, and his wife, Courtney, took the child to a lab and had him tested for drugs.
Why?
According to Michael, he just thought that based on the way this child was acting on this FaceTime call that something was wrong and it could be drugs.
A seven-year-old. Okay.
Now, one fact that is not disputed by either party is that the child tested positive for marijuana and cocaine.
At 7?
Yes.
Okay. Well, that triggers a lot of questions in my mind.
Yes.
A seven-year-old is not freely going about getting cocaine off the street.
Right.
So that makes me wonder where they're getting it. And if Michael is suspecting that they might be on drugs, then my assumption would be that the drugs would be coming from mom's house.
Right.
Not necessarily mom herself,
sure.
But mom's house.
Right. And that's what Michael says. So Michael's version of the story is that he was on FaceTime, thought the kid was acting weird. He got visitation. His mom and his wife took the kid to a lab, got tested positive. Mom's version of the story, Kelly, says that her son is fine. Everything's fine. But he went to Michael's house for the weekend and then magically tested positive for drugs.
Okay, well, so there should be a record of when this test was taken, and it should sync up one way or the other with when said child went to Michael's house.
Right. So before we get into that, what I will say is that according to Michael, again, and this is the problem, like so much of this is he said, she said, but according to Michael, His son told him that Mr. Jake, who is mom's boyfriend, made him lick fizzy rocks.
Okay.
Okay. Now, Kelly, like I said, told police that her son tested positive after spending the weekend with Michael, but that it wasn't because of anything that happened in her home. Now, according to her, Michael had the kids from Thursday to Monday during this period, and that's when he took his son to the lab.
Okay. When was the FaceTime call?
Sometime before Thursday. I'm not exactly sure the amount of time.
Okay.
Between the FaceTime call and when Michael actually got him.
So the reason why I'm asking is because not marijuana, that obviously stays in your system for 30 days.
Right.
Cocaine leaves your system within 72 hours.
It's funny that you bring that up because I'm getting to that.
Okay.
Okay. Now, after Kelly got the kids back, Michael had them from Thursday to Monday. So Kelly got the kids back and then Michael called the cops on her and said like, hey, my son tested positive for marijuana and cocaine.
So did he have the lab results before he took the kids back?
Apparently.
So why would he take the kids back?
Well, okay. So a lot of this is because by this point, 2020, they had several issues. And I think they had both been put on pretty short leashes by the judge. And they very much like had to comply with the custody orders or else they were going to get, you know.
Okay. But I mean.
Okay. So.
Okay. Let's keep going. But
right. Now, there's a body cam video of this police visit to Kelly's house based on this call that Michael made. And it's on our blog. It's a half an hour long. And, you know, basically the officers were asked to do a welfare check on the child.
Sure.
So the officers come to the door and they're like, and Kelly answers and they're like, hey, you know, we'd like to see your son, blah, 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 blah. She brings him to the door. He says, hi. He says he seems totally fine. And the officers send him back in the house. And then they talk to Kelly on the doorstep. And she's like, oh, yes, I know why you're here. My ex is a piece of work. She says that he's called CPS on her like 20 times in the past few weeks and that CPS opened a case and then closed it. She also says that in 2016, he accused her of sexually abusing the kids and that he also accused her father of sexually abusing them. Then she goes on to say that he had the kids for the weekend and her son magically tested positive for drugs. And she wouldn't even know how to expose her kids to drugs, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure.
She's very much painting the picture of my ex is nuts and he gave my 7-year-old cocaine to get back at me. And the cops like are totally on board with this. Like they seem very much like, yes, this is reasonable.
Okay.
When did you say he was with the dad?
This past weekend. I dropped them off on Thursday night and got them back on Monday.
And then that's okay. The same time they tested positive as well.
Yeah.
For that, so, okay.
Tested positive for cocaine while he was with dad?
Yeah.
So, okay. Right now, that's our main concern, the reason why we're out here.
I don't blame you. I'm as mad as you are that, like, like my CPS has even told me that she suspects that Michael gave it to him in order to make it seem like...
Do you know anything about testing for cocaine or anything like
that?
No. So, cocaine stays in the system for 48 hours.
Okay.
Just so you know.
So
if...
Wouldn't that make sense then?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to jump to any conclusion.
I know, I'm just saying.
I just, you know, we can't say here.
No, I understand that. Right, I'm now, just saying, like, my concerns right now are I would never in a million years, I wouldn't even know how to expose my kids to that. And
And back to what you said, one of the officers says, hey, just so you know, cocaine stays in the system for 48 hours. Okay. So you said 72, he says 48, you know.
Whatever. It depends on whether on the type of drug test, but it's fine. Whether it's a blood draw or a piss test.
Right, but we're going to get to that too. So, well, then she says, well, that makes sense, right? If it only stays in your system for 48 hours and he was like, you know, and my son got tested while he was with my husband, then it has to be because of something my husband did, not something that happened at our house.
And the cop is like, depends on when the test was taken.
Right. But the cop is like, yeah, no, you're right. This seems great. So the officer says, look, like, we have to come out. We got this call, but he looks fine. He looks happy. He looks healthy. And to be fair, he absolutely does.
That's all well and good, but those cops also are mandated reporters. So they actually, regardless of what they thought the circumstances were, they should have contacted CPS. And CPS should have opened yet another case.
Well, no. So CPS was already involved. So there are two cops at this point, the cop who's having this conversation who has the body cam and mm-hmm. his partner.
Okay.
Now, during a lot of this conversation, the officer is on the phone with his sergeant talking, like trying to say, like, okay, she says that this is the person from CPS who called her, trying to like figure out what's going on because CPS is involved at this point. So he's talking to his sergeant to like find out who from CPS is involved, like what the status is of that. So, okay. Yes. So the partner is doing.
Okay. So maybe they did cover their bases.
Yeah. Way. In terms of CPS, like I do believe that, yes, they did cover their bases.
Okay.
But I do want to talk about this video. It's around 25 minutes, and like these are my general impressions of it. Like I said, the call starts with two officers, and they, especially the officer with the body cam, are bending over backwards not to make this woman feel uncomfortable. To me, like the whole subtext of this video is she's like, I am a white lady, and this is ridiculous. And they were like, yes, white lady, we agree. Like, how could this be possible? Like, you live in a very nice house and you seem like a very nice person. Like, this is crazy. And I'm just like, there's a lot of privilege being afforded to this white woman who lives in what seems to be a very nice neighborhood that I do not think would be afforded to a person of color living in a less affluent area when her 7-year-old comes up positive for cocaine.
Yeah, no, you're right. I mean, the same circumstances were in, you know, a minority neighborhood or the slums of any inner city, it would be a different story.
Right. And I love the fact, like, the kid tested positive for cocaine. She's not disagreeing with that.
Right.
And they're all like, oh my God, exes, well, am I right?
Yeah, I know. Yeah, that guy.
Right.
But nobody's going the extra step and trying to figure out where he got the cocaine.
No!
Where he was exposed to
Nobody
it.
Nobody seems incredibly interested yeah, in like why this here, 7-year-old...
Here you have a 7-year-old child who tested positive for cocaine.
Cocaine!
Bad enough that he tested positive for marijuana. Like, let's say best case scenario could have been secondhand exposure
exactly.
or whatever. But there is no secondhand exposure to cocaine.
That's... like my thought. So I'm watching this whole video. It's 25 damn minutes. I'm like, am I crazy? Like, why are people so calm about this? Like,
right. Yeah.
Everybody was extremely chill during this whole thing. And I'm like, this 7-year-old had cocaine in his system. Like, we should be getting to the bottom of this.
Right. And even if it was, let's say, a secondhand exposure to crack, hey, that's still a pretty heavy drug. To be using around a child. So, you know, maybe do a little bit more of investigating there. Like, hey, who has cocaine? Like,
yes. Yeah. So like during this, she goes through her whole history of her custody issues with Michael that apparently started in 2017 when she called the cops on him around Easter. He apparently had sent her a series of unhinged text messages and told the kids that he had found out that he was a real angel and that when they came to visit him Easter weekend, that they could all be angels together.
What?
Well, exactly.
What the fuck?
Exactly. So Kelly is like, this doesn't seem great. So she called the cops on him and filed a report with them and with CPS. Now, both agencies investigated, but it doesn't seem like anything really came of it. And like this was in 2017, obviously, like all three of the kids are fine. And, you know, there's the police report to back this up. So I'm just going to assume that this is a generally true story. So Michael clearly seems to have some issues. She also says that a few days after this whole Easter police report thing is when he started accusing her and her father of sexually abusing the kids.
And that just, according to her, comes out of nowhere.
Right. And like from her perspective, it's basically revenge for her calling the cops on him.
Okay.
And also during this whole porch interview with the police, she drops in a few things about her own home life that I do believe raise red flags. So Jake Bellingham is her boyfriend. He lives in the home and the couple has a baby together. So she has her three kids with Michael and then she has this baby with Jake. But she casually mentions that the police have been called to her home a few times because she and Jake have had fights, as she calls it.
Okay.
So, like, alarm bells are going off for me when I'm hearing this. Because I've had a lot of fights with significant others, but never any that the police have gotten involved in.
We've had some doozies.
But this coalesces with something that I read that said in December of 2019, Kelly called 911 after barricading herself in the bedroom with her kids because of a domestic violence incident with Jake.
So again, I'm going to push the CPS role. To me, taking this from a CPS perspective, do we know, was CPS notified about this domestic?
I don't know specifically, but I do know that anytime Michael got a hint of something going badly at the house, that he did notify CPS.
So this domestic incident, this is not the first incident that involved CPS, correct?
No, there have been many incidents that have involved CPS on both ends because they've both been calling CPS on each other for years at this point.
So I'm taking this from my experience being an intake investigator. So what an intake investigator, at least at my agency, was, mm-hmm. I was the first to investigate whether there was allegations of child abuse. And the child abuse could be a myriad of things. So mm-hmm. it doesn't necessarily mean beating. I was involved in all kinds of things that had like nothing to do with physical abuse or mental abuse. It was, you know, secondhand to something like this.
Yeah. Basically creating an unsafe environment.
Correct.
Right?
Yes. An unsafe environment. So regardless of the individual circumstances of each individual interaction, whether it was founded or unfounded, whether mm-hmm. the founded or unfounded meaning that CPS was going to take on the case for family services, for ongoing services. If it was unfounded, that just means whatever this allegation was investigated. There was no evidence either of it happening or there was no need for us to continue on with this family to offer mm-hmm. services to them. So regardless of the amount of individual founded or unfounded cases, let's say that this family had a bunch of individual unfounded cases, mm-hmm. we would get that in the history. So we would get the jacket, which would be a folder super, super thick of all of the investigations.
You would see that they're frequent flyers.
Correct. Yes, exactly. So given that, and any social worker that would get this would review the cases before they would go out to investigate. Given that, and given the severity of this circumstance in particular, like at some point you would need to start developing it or offering it to long-term services. So it would transfer from my desk as an intake investigator to the family services portion, which would be the long-term services. You get one social worker that interacts with you, that covers your case for years, mm-hmm. offering you different services, offering help with whatever is needed. And that's generally how CPS is supposed to work.
Yeah, and I do think something like that probably happened here. Just because of all of the court cases that eventually happened, it seems that, you know, there were the courts, there was the guardian ad litem, there was CPS, and I think they were kind of all working together on a long-term basis.
Yeah.
Again, at this particular point, you know, I don't know where they are in that process. But she also tells the police that there was another incident in which Michael called CPS on her. So apparently, and it sounds like she said it was like earlier that year, which this was in the end of May of 2020. So it might have been the beginning of 2020. I'm not exactly sure. But she apparently had either found out that Jake was cheating on her or she suspected him of cheating on her. So she took the kids and went to Oklahoma to stay with Jake's Nana.
Without Michael's permission?
Well, yeah. And so Michael was not happy with that. So then Michael called CPS and told them that she had fled the state with the kids.
You're also dealing with custody issues as
yeah.
well. So he's calling CPS about it, short of issuing like a parental kidnapping notification through law enforcement. There's not really anything CPS can do other than take note and hope that they come back.
Yeah.
Because and so, that's completely outside of their jurisdiction.
Well, what it sounds like, and this is just based on kind of what Kelly is telling the police in this body cam footage, she said that CPS, wherever they were in Oklahoma, apparently came out, she says, at 3 a.m. to do a welfare check.
Okay.
Like, I don't know.
Okay. I mean, look, I worked a lot of odd hours as a CPS investigator, but I definitely never worked like an overnight shift.
Yeah.
So although some jurisdictions do have overnight CPS workers on call, I was never one of them.
Yeah.
My work hours ended at 5, even though I obviously worked longer than that, depending on the case. But, you know, I wasn't getting a phone call at 3 a.m.
to go do a welfare check.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, so they went into this welfare check and according to Kelly, they said that everything was fine, which, you know, I'm sure it was
sure.
at the time. Right.
Right. Well, also because if let's say that happened, mm-hmm. CPS's priority is the children at that point. And,
well, exactly.
You know, if the children are fine, they're not going to get into the minutiae of child custody agreement and parental kidnapping, whatever, because
right.
CPS's standpoint is if the children are healthy,
safe yeah.
and with a parent or a family member,
yeah,
then they wash their hands of it.
Right. And I do think the kids weren't like in danger in this situation or anything. And, you know, and I think more than likely at this point, Kelly did have more custody of them than Michael did. So more than likely, and I don't know this for a fact, but more than likely, like the kids were supposed to be with her anyway.
Right.
So it's not like Michael had visitation and she was keeping them from him by going to Oklahoma. What I believe was the case is that they were supposed to be with her regardless, and she just happened to be in Oklahoma, you know, without Michael's permission or prior knowledge.
Right, and that may be a moot point depending on the rules in the county in which they live as far as the separation and child agreement.
Yeah.
That's county-based. Or jurisdictional based,
right.
Like that is, so it varies all over the board. I know here, that would not be parental kidnapping,
mm-hmm.
Unless it was a long-term move.
Right. And this apparently was a week and
right.
then she went home.
Yeah.
You know, and while accusing Kelly of fleeing the state does seem like a bit of an overreaction, like I kind of get the thought behind it, which is that, you know, my kids are in this situation that doesn't seem to be healthy to the point where my ex-wife felt that she needed to go to another state with them.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, that definitely needs to be documented. But
yeah.
We're not at the point of like parental kidnapping is where
no,
we're going.
No. And I think what you see a lot of the time is like, yes, something's wrong, but Michael kind of takes it to another level where it isn't necessarily at that point. Now, the officer mentions at one point that there have been a lot of calls to this address, which apparently he kind of found out as he was taking this call. And it sounds like a combination of Michael calling the cops on Kelly for various reasons and calls related to these quote unquote fights between her, you know, Kelly and Jake. Toward the end of the video, a third officer shows up, and this is the officer who apparently like has this beat. Like, he was on another call at the time, so that's why he wasn't the responding officer, but he got done with his call and this was like an address he was familiar with.
Right.
So he rolls up and he's like, "Oh, hey, how's your baby?" Yeah. And she's like, "He's good, thanks." And he said, "You remember talking to me a few months ago?"
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Like, this is a very nice neighborhood, but the cops know this family.
I mean, yeah, this is all about building a case.
Yeah. All right. So let's get back to this drug test.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes. We've been going off on these tangents and like, okay.
Let's get back to the drug test but I do think there was 72 hours.
Like, yeah, there was a lot
of really interesting information about that home that I think Kelly kind of inadvertently gave access to in this like porch interview or whatever. So I do think it's important to talk about to kind of get a full picture. But, you know, so this drug test, the one that the first officer basically dismisses because cocaine only stays in your system, according to him, for 48 hours. Now, if Michael is to be believed, and again, this is the problem with this whole drug test. I don't have a third party source that says, this is the drug test that was performed. This is the data was performed. These are the findings, right?
Right.
What I have is Kelly's version of this and Michael's version of this.
Okay.
Now, Michael's version is that it was a hair follicle test that was done. And according to Michael, this test was done on the first day that the child was in his care after being with his mother for the previous 66 days.
66 days. So yes. That's definitely not 50-50 custody, first of all.
Right. I think because that was 2015.
Okay. So by this 2020, point, who the hell
there
knows?
There is no, yeah. Who, okay. Yeah. It's just, I don't know. Now, according to labtestsonline.org, drug use does not appear in the hair for 7 to 10 days. So if the timeline that Michael is giving is correct, and Kelly does not give an alternate timeline during this video, then it couldn't have happened when the child was with Michael. It had to have happened when the child was with Kelly.
Why did they do a hair follicle test?
I don't know. And I don't know for sure that they did. Right. That's the other thing. Like I said, I have no third party verification of this. All I have is that both parents do say that this 7-year-old child tested positive for cocaine and marijuana, but I don't have any third party verification of any other aspect of this claim.
Okay.
But, you know, what really strikes me, and we kind of touched on this before, is like the extremely casual nature that she talks about this in this video.
And everybody brushes it aside.
She literally says, "I'm just as mad as you are," to the cop. Like, you know, my crazy ex gave my 7-year-old cocaine. Like, can you believe that? Like, And like, what the fuck?
Like, yeah, again, like at this point, if I'm the officer on scene, I'm telling my partner, call CPS. We need to like figure out who the hell is supplying this kid with drugs and get them out of whichever house that is.
Right.
And have CPS involved because CPS can do a child removal.
Exactly. And like, I can kind of understand this attitude if the child had only tested positive for marijuana, because like you brought up earlier, that could have been like a secondhand
situation. Yeah. Yeah.
Which is not great. Like,
no,
I'm definitely not saying that's a cool thing to do.
Not at all. However,
it's not nearly as bad as giving a 7-year-old cocaine.
And what did he say? Licking rock candy or something
like
that?
Yeah, he said fizzy rocks.
Fizzy rocks.
Yeah.
Okay. I mean, so was there any more investigation into what that meant?
No. So here's the thing. This happened again a year ago. So a year and a half ago at this point, almost. It was May 29th, 2020 was the date of this body cam footage. And like, I guess there was an investigation, but like no charges were ever brought against anybody for this.
What the fuck?
I have no idea.
How do you just like gloss over the fact that a 7-year-old tested positive
for
cocaine?
It's like this story is about Sophie. Obviously.
Yeah, I know. We haven't even gotten to her.
Haven't even gotten to her because like this is fucking insane. And like all of the stories glossed over this. Like, and I'm just like, wait, like hold up. Like we cannot just like go. It's a 7-year-old.
Yeah. So there needs to be some sort of investigation.
Like something is very extremely wrong here.
Right.
With one family, with the other family, with both families. Like, I don't know, but something is extremely, extremely wrong.
Yeah.
And everybody in this body cam footage is just incredibly chill about it.
Once again, CPS at this point needs to be involved and they should be the ones investigating this. I mean, like, look, law enforcement, the guys that show up on scene, like, first off, they shouldn't be like, oh yeah, well, no big deal.
Yeah.
7-year-old test positive for cocaine. Like, they should be asking a little bit more as far as like, where did they get said cocaine? Where?
No, nothing. There was not a single question about any of that.
But ultimately, that
they were like, oh, this kid looks fine. I guess this is just like a dumb call that okay. We have to do.
But ultimately, that leads to child welfare issues, which is CPS's realm. Now, CPS, here's a fun little side note about CPS is that while they are, by law, if this was reported to them, would have to go and investigate, everybody can just refuse to answer questions or even answer the fucking door mm-hmm. when CPS shows up. But the CPS agent, by law, has to see the child.
Right.
Otherwise, they can go to jail.
Yeah.
It's like, it's a terrible system. It's completely rigged against the social workers, and it's insanely stressful. However, they also, once, if they deem it that this child is not safe at home, they can remove the child from the home. Now, again, the parents can be like, no, you're not taking my kid. And at which point, then the CPS can say, well, I'm calling the cops and the right. cops are going to forcibly remove you.
And then it goes to court
you.
And then there's a whole thing.
Well, it goes
yeah,
to court regardless.
Yeah. Yeah.
If you're removing the child from the home, then sure. there's a whole hearing that takes place.
And that does happen in this story
okay.
down the line. So, like, that's this police call. Again, this was May 29th, 2020. Now, this is kind of in the middle of the COVID-19 right. lockdown, right?
Yes.
So like schools are closed for the most part, you know, kids are home with their parents.
And there are issues with courts being open and
exactly.
And
a lot of courts were closed.
Right.
Like a lot of things were getting pushed aside, backed up. Like it was just a mess.
I can't imagine family court was, was like open and doing things.
Right. So around this time, Sophie was also writing her dad letters. Now, Sophie was nine and a half-ish at this time. Apparently, after one of her visits with him, he kind of sent her back, like, you know, he sent back her backpack. And in it, he put envelopes and stamps so that she could write to him. And he, during this whole thing, gave those letters to the Daily Mail. And so they're all available online, and they're incredibly disturbing. Now, no matter what you believe about the rest of the story, including the accusations made on the viral video that we haven't even talked about yet, please understand how serious this is. This 9-year-old child wrote her dad a letter thanking him for leaving candy in her backpack. She says in the letter that she stopped crying as soon as she found it. And then she says, "We need a code for when I get mail." As part of the custody agreement, they have these FaceTime calls together. But it seems as though these calls are monitored by Kelly or Jake or both. So in the letter, Sophie comes up with code words. For send mail, it's roses. For receive mail, it's paint. For danger, it's dandelions or daisies. And for fight, it's pen.
Just the simple fact that she's coming up with code words.
Yeah.
Leads me to believe that there are bigger issues.
Exactly. Like, this is not the behavior of a healthy, happy 9-year-old child.
Right. Regardless of whether the FaceTime calls were monitored, like, why does she feel scared?
Yeah.
About letting them know that she's getting mail or wants to send mail to her father.
Right.
Like, that raises a huge red flag.
Exactly. So, like, just the very fact, and again, you can see this letter, like, it's in her handwriting. She wrote this. She came up with this. And there's just, I don't see any way in which this is not indicative of a larger, really concerning issue.
Yeah, I agree. It screams to me, it's borderline hostage situation.
Yeah.
You know?
In the letters, she also says that Mr. Jake took her iPad away for a week because she wouldn't stop crying. And that he tells her and her brothers that Michael is brainwashing them. So later during this whole thing, Michael posted videos of one of their FaceTime calls and Sophie is using the code words.
Wow.
We've gone a long time into this episode and we haven't even gotten to the viral video that made this national news in the first place. So this is all in May of 2020, everything that we've been talking about. The video that kind of started this whole thing from the public's perspective took place on August 14th, 2020. Now, by this time, things had deteriorated to the point where the child handoff between Kelly and Michael had to be done in a Starbucks parking lot with Kelly's mother in attendance. Kelly and Michael live nearly 300 miles away from each other.
Jesus.
Yeah. They live in Texas. So,
I guess everything's bigger in Texas.
Big state, yeah. They live in Frisco and Seguin, Texas, respectively. So they meet at around the halfway point, which is in Lacey Lakeview, Texas. So this video takes place in Lacey Lakeview. Now, I haven't seen the entire video because the judge has ordered Michael to remove it from the internet. So I've seen excerpts that other people have posted because if you go to any of the original embedded videos, they're all gone. Mm-hmm. And this whole thing started from the public perspective, with Michael, his wife, and like other family members starting a GoFundMe to raise money for legal bills related to this custody case. The GoFundMe page reads in part, quote, Sophie, 9 years old, has disclosed that she has been continuously subjected to domestic violence, sexual grooming, and most recently, molestation/rape in her primary residence. Her father is fighting for her life while her abusers pull every resource to get their hands back on her. The biological mother, according to Sophie, is a part of the sexual abuse and is encouraging it. End quote. Now, this video is, I believe, about 20 minutes long. In it, Sophie is screaming and crying and hyperventilating, saying that she doesn't want to leave her father and go back to her mother's house. Michael is in the driver's seat and is filming this. His father's in the passenger seat. Kelly and her mom are outside of the car trying to get Sophie out. So apparently these handoffs have gone badly before. So Michael has been told that he has to like stay in the car and not interfere in any way. So you and I have a child who turned 4 about a month ago. And he loves throwing tantrums. And they get extremely intense sometimes.
Yes, they do.
Like, much more so than I think either of our other kids. Well, maybe not Sander, but they're bad.
Yeah.
And when we're trying to be good and, like, do good parenting to him. We get like that fake calm voice and we say things like, I'm sorry you're feeling this way, buddy, but we have to put our shoes on now.
Right. Yeah. Right. Yeah. Yeah.
And that's how this scene plays out. But Sophie is in four. She's almost 10 when this video is taken. And she is screaming and begging not to go. Grandma is physically trying to drag her out of the car, first by her arm and then by her feet. Sophie kicks off her cowboy boots at one point in an effort to get away from her. Now, this video was taken a year ago and investigations have been done, and we're going to get into all of that, but this is what I see watching this video. I see a little girl who is terrified of something. And I see a mother and a grandmother who are gaslighting her. After they stop physically trying to pull her out of the car, they get that fake tantrum voice going. And I don't want to play a lot of this audio because I don't think it's appropriate, and I think the judge took it down for a reason, but I do want to play the small snippet of Sophie calling them out on their bullshit because this seems like an extremely intelligent and self-possessed child, and I think that that's important and relevant. She is standing up for herself. Ethan has not seen any of this before, and I played him the part that I just put in for you guys, but he also watched a little bit more just so he could have a little bit more context. What I get from this is that they're talking to her like she's four. They're saying adults know best, mommies and daddies have to listen to the judges, et cetera, et cetera. But here's the part that puts me into a blind rage. She tells them very clearly that she's being molested, and they completely blow her off.
I didn't hear that in the video.
I know, you didn't see that part. Her grandmother asks, "Who's touching you?" She says, "Mr. Jake and Mommy watches. Mommy watches it happen." Her grandmother asks, "Where does he touch you?" Sophie says, "My Vivi." So first of all, this is why we always need to teach our children to use proper names for the genitalia in case, God forbid, anything like this happens, because we want it to be very clear what is happening and where and all of that, because penis and vagina are not dirty words and no one has a VV. But beyond that, the grandma first says, "I guarantee that didn't happen."
It's incredibly, incredibly difficult to watch. And it's very easy to not listen to a kid or blow off a kid's claims, especially when there is this hostile situation going on with the parents. Mm-hmm. But like, somebody has to listen to the kid. Yeah, there are times when kids make things up, or that they say things that may not be exactly what they mean. But when you're talking about, when you're witnessing this and seeing the level of anxiety that she's going through, and fear, this isn't something that's made up. These are true feelings.
Right. This is coming from somewhere real.
Yeah.
The grandma saying, "I guarantee this didn't happen," is obviously fucking terrible, but...
Well, she doesn't want to believe that her daughter could be involved in it.
Yeah.
But nobody in this situation, I'm sorry, not even Michael, the dad, mm-hmm. is really listening to Sophie. He might be, but I don't care what judge's order is in place. I don't care if they're going to take me to jail. If my child is acting this way and telling me these things, I'm not letting her go back. And I'm not saying this to blame Michael. I'm saying it because nobody in this situation is listening to Sophie. Nobody is. And I say it because somebody needs to listen to her. And I know I keep bringing up CPS, but that's their role. In this situation, it's their role to listen to the child, not the parents. Yes, you interview the parents, sure, but you listen to the child. And it doesn't seem like anybody was listening to any of the kids, not just Sophie. This is terrible. I mean, that's...
Well, so yes, it's objectively terrible, but it somehow gets even worse because as the video goes on, Sophie tells Grandma that her mom and Mr. Jake make her feel bad about herself. And Grandma says, well, if you feel so bad about yourself, how did you get the lead in the school play? Like, how do you do gymnastics?
The fuck does that have to do with anything?
Well, exactly. And what bothers me so much about it is I think that it shows that this goes way beyond a messy custody dispute where one side thinks the other side is brainwashing the kids and feeding them stories. This, to me, shows a fundamental misunderstanding of abuse and how abused children can behave.
Yeah, for sure. Well, I think that that's a whole other bigger issue is that across the board, most people don't understand how abuse works, don't understand how abused kids behave, don't understand how abused adults behave. Most people don't understand that because it's not a world in which most people live or experience.
Right. And
or if they do, they're still in it and they can't analyze it and vocalize it.
Right. To me, this shows that if this were something happened to Sophie under any circumstances, regardless of her parents' divorce and the custody issues, like if anything happened to Sophie, she doesn't have a support system who would believe her or take her seriously. And Sophie calls her grandma out on this in the video. When she starts talking about gymnastics and the school play and everything, Sophie's like, this doesn't have anything to do with what I'm saying. This girl is incredibly self-possessed and she is smart and she is brave. And she knows that these adults are not on her side. So basically what ends up happening after this is Michael posts the video in the GoFundMe campaign, and he ends up raising over $200,000, and the Stand With Sophie hashtag is born. You know, people watch this and they're enraged and sickened, and you know, you can read the comments, like the video isn't up, but the comments still are, and it's like, you know, I was this little girl, like I was Sophie. You know, you have other people who watch and say, like, this reminds me of how my children would act when I had to have them go see their abusive father. You know, people, it resonated with them. After this gets all the attention, you know, there's a flurry of custody hearings and a lot of court appearances, and CPS is very much involved. Sophie actually ended up staying with her father that night. So she didn't go with her mom and grandmother after this, and he ended up taking her to the hospital where it was determined that she had sustained injuries from her grandmother and mom trying to physically drag her out of the car, like they injured her ankle. Now, over the next few months, partially because Sophie was physically injured during this, Michael was granted full custody of the kids, but then a few months later, it was taken away. He filed a temporary restraining order on Kelly. She filed one on him, and just custody continued to flip-flop. People were doxing Kelly and Jake. They were sending them death threats. Michael tried to get Trump to intervene. The chief of police in Lacey Lakeview had to come out and be like, please stop yelling at us for not investigating the sexual assault. We are literally the middlemen in this situation. Like, nothing happened in our county. None of these people live here.
Yeah, right? Yeah. No, yeah. You're right. You're right. Yeah.
You know, it was a complete shit show for the next year. And I'm sure all three of the children suffered greatly.
Yes.
From this.
Yeah.
Kelly's lawyers tried to get the GoFundMe shut down on the basis of fraud. According to a press release, they said, quote, we are unfortunately dealing with a very volatile and increasingly dangerous situation. Michael Long will seemingly stop at nothing to destroy his ex-wife, even if it wreaks massive psychological damage on his family and involves stealing money from the public through false claims, end quote. According to Kelly's side, Michael's motivation for all of this is money. Quote, Michael Long has substantial financial woes, which appears to be motivation for his attempts to monetize his child custody case. He filed for bankruptcy in 2011, leaving a debt of nearly $500,000. His current source of income is produced through a business that he runs with his wife, Courtney Chalmers, and family, in which they sell sand infused with spiritual energy online, end quote. They go on to point out that Michael and his wife, Courtney, live in an RV on his parents' property. While the GoFundMe did get frozen for a time after this claim of fraud, it didn't get shut down. It does remain up to this day, though it does say that organizers have stopped accepting donations. There's also disagreement about what doctors have found regarding the alleged sexual abuse. The GoFundMe alludes to medical issues that Sophie had in her private areas that Sophie has faced, which another article clarified as vaginosis and yeast infections. And again, use the correct words when you are talking about things like this. But Kelly's lawyers have accused Michael of doctor shopping to get a diagnosis that would support his claims. They say that medical examinations have found no evidence of sexual abuse. And that's where we're going to end this week. We'll have part two up next week, but for those of you on Patreon, you can access it now. Like, this case is just so incredibly difficult. A little girl has said that she's being sexually abused at her mother's house, and her mother says that her father is brainwashing her with these stories. This week, we talked about the events that led to the Stand With Sophie hashtag, and next week, we're going to talk about what has led to the Bring Sophie Home hashtag. We're also going to Michael and Kelly, and how no one can seem to agree on who the hero is in this story and who's the villain. Sophie Elise Long has been missing since July 12, 2021. She is believed to be with her father, Michael Long. Sophie is 11 years old, 5 feet tall, and approximately 95 pounds, with blonde hair and blue eyes. She has a small scar from a burn on one of her arms. Michael Long is 43 years old. He is 6'4" and approximately 205 pounds. Michael Long is possibly driving an off-white 2010 Ford Edge SUV or a gray van with blacked out windows, an NRA sticker, and a black rack on top. Anyone with information on the case is urged to contact the Texas Department of Public Safety's Missing Persons Clearinghouse at 512-424-5074. You can see all the sources for this episode along with photos and videos at our website, andthentheyweregone.com.
And be sure to follow us on social, And Then They Were Gone Pod on Facebook and at ATTWG Pod on Instagram and Twitter. If you like what we're doing, please subscribe and consider leaving a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. It will help new listeners find us. And the more people that listen, the more chances we have of bringing someone home.
Part two is up now on Patreon, or we'll see you here next week for a brand new episode.
See you next week.
And Then They Were Gone is hosted by Kona Gallagher and Ethan Flick. Our research, writing, and editing is done by Kona Gallagher. Theme music is The Stork by Ketza. Additional music is provided by Kai Engel. And Then They Were Gone is a Little Monster production.
Hey, you can do it!